Welcome to episode 150 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my returning guest is a contributor to CinemaScope and a senior contributor to Film School Rejects. Joining me from Vancouver, Meg Shields. Welcome back to Junk Filter.
Hi. Your mother sucks cocks in hell, Jesse.
Thank you for being my 150th guest, Meg.
No, don't thank me yet. You don't know what I have planned.
It's spooky season, so of course I had to ask Meg back on, a horror enthusiast, to talk about a movie that I've actually never seen in its entirety.
Boo.
I have seen Exorcist 2. I've seen Exorcist 3, but I've never actually seen the OG, William Friedkin's 1973 spooktacular, The Exorcist, which turns 50 years old this year. I have to say, before we get going on this episode, what a picture. It lived up to okay. All my expectations. Yeah, it was not bad at all.
That's right. And you're now a practicing Catholic, as Blatty would have wanted.
When I was a little kid, I was so frightened about the entire idea of The Exorcist.
I mean, that's the point. We will talk about it, but like, it is trying to scare you straight. Straight to the church.
That's right.
It's true. Like
the street, the house, the door, the room, the mother, the child, the exorcist.
The Exorcist, rated R. Under 17, not admitted without a parent.
You may think it's bizarre that I know so much about film, and yet I haven't seen one of the most famous movies of all time until this week.
Yeah, but if you know about how that film exploded in terms of popularity and stuff, like, and you were young enough, I can see being scared stiff. Like they really played up that this movie was gonna, you know, rock your world, like almost to Roger Corman levels of like barf bags and stuff. Which I will say, having been to enough Midnight Madness screenings where people drop like flies, like I don't not believe it. Mm-hmm. But also Friedkin is a big fish boy who does tell tales. So,
were you at the Julia DeCorno film where people were like throwing up and they had to go get an ambulance?
No, but I heard enough first reports that I do believe. Yeah, you know, you always think that, you know, folks from the past are exaggerating, but then you go see, you know, something like the DeCorno where people can't deal, and you're like, oh, yeah, okay.
I watched this incredible historical video of original screenings of The Exorcist where people were lined up around the block and down the street.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
They're so funny. And then they have footage in the lobby of people stumbling out of the theater crying and having to go crash on the couch.
It's the best PR the Catholic Church has had since, I don't know, the 1400s. Like, it was good for business. I don't know what to tell you.
This was the days before you could go to the Cineplex website and book your ticket. These were the olden days where you had to line up for 5 hours and then find out that the movie just sold out when you're getting up to the box office.
Yeah, but that meant that those audiences were hyped, right? Like whoever did get in was ready to rock and roll.
But then they had people crying in the lobby, and men and women too. Apparently lots of men were fainting at the screenings. Not just
doesn't
women.
Surprise me. Well, at the De Corneau, it was all men apparently who ate shit because they simply could not.
Just the other night, this guy came out and I looked out the door and he was lying on the floor.
He's really big. You wouldn't have expected. I know. All these big guys, they come out and they look like they're ghosts or something. And
they asked for Somalian salts and everything.
It's not the kind of people you'd expect to faint.
Yeah.
That didn't scare me. I don't know what happened. I just fainted. It was frightening.
It just scared me to death. Things just like this, really scared me to death. I'm just nervous.
Do you remember what particular scene it was that...
When she was in a room, the doctors came in, and she was... I guess it was when she was talking to Devil's voice. Oh,
it's frightening.
Do you think she'll go back in?
I don't know. I have a friend in there alone, and I don't want to leave her in there alone, so I probably will.
but it's just, it's incredibly frightening.
Meg, have you ever seen a movie that was that terrifying to you that you couldn't handle it?
No, actually. So we're doing the 31 Days of Horror over at Film School Rejects, a very stupid project where we do one top 10 horror list every single day in October. And we have one list that has already been published that's about the best horror films of 93. And I covered Kronos, the Guillermo del Toro debut. That's the only film, period, that I've had to stop watching because I was so in my feelings about it. And it wasn't because it was too scary. It's because I really didn't want anything bad to happen to that grandpa. And I was just like, I had a moment where I was like, you know what? We're going to Schrodinger's cat this. I'm going to stop watching it. And I've literally never done that for a movie before. So I don't know. That's like the other side of the coin of terror when you're just so invested and you don't want anything bad to happen that you nope out of it. But I tend to power through things. Like even stuff I think is genuinely scary, even to horror fans, like Wreck or something. You're on the roller coaster, baby. Oh, I'm a big liar. I the movie that scared me the most as a child was Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island, which is very funny now as a fan of The Beyond, because the Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island to The Beyond pipeline is like a straight shot. it's like a super highway.
I mean, I've seen movies that left me shaken for days afterwards, like Kiyoshi Kurosawa's Cure.
sure.
like that movie fucked me up for a long time.
Yes, I think
I'd like to see it again. I'd like to do an episode about that movie, except then I'd have to watch Cure again, and I don't know if I could do it.
Well, ontologically, I think like terror and disturbing are two different feelings as you watch a film, or even like being grossed out. Like for some reason, when James Gunn was like fresh out of his trauma university and doing Slither, like I find that film repulsive. Like something about it, I think it's how gleeful it is, actually turns my stomach. And I'm on watch lists. Like I watch horrible things, but for some reason Slither like really bothered me. But that's repulsion, which is different than terror, which is different from being disturbed. And I think honestly, depending on who you are, The Exorcist ticks all three at different points. depending on which cut you're watching, so, and how visually clear what you're seeing is. I'm sure there's some horrible pan and scans out there, but.
Yeah. Well, I watched for this episode, the original 1973 version, the theatrical cut. I did not watch the version you've never seen, which was the director's cut from 2000. That's how they marketed it.
It's good, in my opinion.
You were okay with the changes? I know they're controversial because, like for instance, they kind of messed up the great ending to The Exorcist in the director's cut.
Kind of in that they prolong the medallion gifting. I can't really remember what the big difference is.
They prolong the medallion gifting, and then they also have a sort of coda where Lee J. Cobb's cop is talking to the priest who.
Oh, that's right.
Administered the last rites, and Lee J. Cobb's cop is sort of movie obsessed, so he starts talking to the priest about movies and stuff. And
I think it's fun. Kind of,
but it kind of
they didn't carry that over to Exorcist 3. It wasn't like George C. Scott being like, the movies.
Yeah. There's a certain amount of movie mindset, registered trademark Will Meneker in The Exorcist, because Ellen Burstyn's character is an actress, and we see her working on a movie in Georgetown.
Yeah. I think the most salient argument against the director's cut is that it really like underlines the thesis of the film. But given that so many people have misunderstood it over the years, maybe it's warranted. Also, famously, Blatty and Friedkin butted heads about everything while making yes. in a productive way. But I think after a certain amount of time, Friedkin came around to certain things. So I've seen much worse director's cuts. Let's put it that way.
When Friedkin was making The Exorcist, his cut was originally something like 140 minutes, but Warner Brothers wanted a Christmas movie that came in at under 2 hours. So he hacked it down. There's all this stuff that's not really clear and maybe not even all that clear to the director that are part of the power
How
of this movie.
How dare you? How dare you? Are you saying that Friedkin wasn't in total control of everything at every time while making this film?
I think that Friedkin was following creative impulses when he was making
the movie.
Please,
the guiding spirit of God. No, I'm kidding.
It has been said that the film The Exorcist has taken the more exploitive elements of the novel and left out maybe some of the meatier aspects. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. Who said that? First, let's talk about who said it.
Okay, it has been said in some reviews.
By who?
Film critics.
Which one?
Okay, I don't have specifics with me, but that has been said.
I've never heard that. Let's put it that way. My attitude about the book was it was a great classic work of literature. I believe that The Exorcist will be, the novel will be regarded years from now as the works of Edgar Allan Poe are regarded today.
I mean, we just lost Hurricane Billy a couple of months ago.
Yeah, great.
One of my absolute heroes.
Yeah,
And it's so funny because he means so much to me, and yet I had never seen The Exorcist.
I mean, he probably wouldn't mind that. Like, I don't think it's his favorite thing he's ever done. Like, he's usually pretty dismissive of it often. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think it's his heart favorite. So I think he would have been okay.
Your general feelings on William Friedkin, Meg?
Oh, the goat. Chaotic bisexual, like, maniac. I love him to death. He's the best. And, like, the heroic journey he did from being like a little brat from the 1970s where he would endanger everyone's lives to him becoming like quite restrained and stately, I think is great. And like, what a storyteller. Like, they're not all true, but who cares? like his entire friendship with Nicholas Rending Refn brings me like indescribable joy. Like, I don't know if you've seen that clip, but
oh,
I'm sure you have.
Many times.
On repeat, yes. Anyone who's listening who hasn't seen it, I won't spoil anything. Just Google those two names together and you're in for a wild ride. No, he's the best. His autobiography rips. He's, he was a living, museum piece, and he will be dearly missed. And I'm a Jade defender. I love Jade. I love it all, baby.
I saw Jade in a movie theater.
I'm jealous. Jade good.
Now, do we know conclusively whether or not Friedkin was bisexual?
No,
theory.
Not conclusively, but he's very jokingly, like, people will say, like, they'll insinuate that he's straight, and then he'll be like, how do you know? It's like, he's done that enough times that it's like, at least give him a badge, make him an honorary member. I choose to believe, Jesse, and as we know from The Exorcist, belief is everything, baby. He's dead now. What's he going to do?
There was an interview with Refn where Refn was saying, you're a heterosexual guy or whatever. And
yes,
like,
that's
Friedkin
probably
pushed back on that. But Friedkin was like, no, like, he didn't really elaborate, but he also didn't really want to be thought of as a heterosexual.
Yeah, which I'm taking, man. Taking that straight to the bank. Good enough for me.
You know, like, to live and die in L.A. to me is the work of a gay guy.
That is, a straight man did not make that movie.
No.
A straight man did not make Cruising.
Yeah.
Like, no. I refuse to accept that.
He was married to Sherry Lansing for a long time. He was married to Jean Moreau for a while. Like, I always got the sense of him being a serial monogamist, you know? Like, he was constantly getting married. And nightmare stories about his various relationships, although I think he had a happy marriage with Sherry Lansing.
I think so, too. And it's funny, like, I think Blatty was also divorced, like, three times or something, which is incredibly funny in the context of this film, which is incredibly anti-divorce.
Yes.
Very funny that two monogamous men who kept having failed relationships were like, maybe exorcism and divorce linked? Question.
Well, this leads me to something that I read in Peter Biskin's book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. For about a page or two, Biskin goes off on what he perceived to be the sort of patriarchal tone of The Exorcist. He posited that The Exorcist is actually a very reactionary film, and he also congratulated himself when he said that women were rightly horrified by some of the things that happened in this movie, because the movie posits that a single parent household with no father in it is the devil's playground. He said that the movie carries this general male nightmare view of female puberty and the crucifix masturbation scene, puberty as demonic possession, and Friedkin and Blatty working out some guilt that they had about their own mothers, because that's a real running theme throughout the movie. you know, and it reminds me a little bit of one of the clunker lines in the new Exorcist film where Ellen Burstyn's character returns for this legacy sequel and says in a clunker line of dialogue that she wasn't allowed to witness the exorcism because of the patriarchy.
That makes me want to puke like green slime. I fucking hate that. David Gordon Green, I hope you rot in hell, baby. No, what, I don't know. Like,
what's your take on?
I mean, it's an incredibly socially conservative film in like a variety of ways beyond being patriarchal, but that is like the main one that like the McNeil's lack a daddy in a spiritual and a domestic sense, and that there's, you know, a litany of father figures to choose from in this film, spiritual and otherwise. So yeah, I do think like, and there's some very like funny framing shots at the end, especially in the director's cut, where it's like both Ellen Bernstein and Regan McNeil and a member of the church all in one frame and being like, this is how we know we're at the happy ending, because this is the perfect family. But yeah, no, the whole, I think it's honestly like the social conservatism to me, the strongest and most poignant message of it is, or one of them anyway, is the requirement of a daddy. And that there's no daddy in that home, and the devil sees an opportunity, whatever. I think that's like a pretty clear thesis. I also think The Exorcist, you see a lot more of this argument for slashers, but I mean, I think a good branch of horror, if not all of it, is socially conservative and interested in conversion narratives. And I think The Exorcist is like a pretty textbook example of that, of being, you know, pro-nuclear family, pro-religious institutions. Like, very famously, this film like was great for the church and like really did a lot of work to argue for, you know, the presence of demons on this earthly plane, blah, blah, blah. And it's the scared straight thing. Like, it's the same with slashers, where it's like, if you're boinking and drinking and partying, you will be murdered, justly so. Like, it's the fuck them kids as politics thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, here this is a very pro-church film, very pro-daddy film. One of the reasons I think that the director's cut is more thematically cohesive is there is a moment between Marin and Karis where I think Karis has just been, you know, the demon assumes the likeness of his mom and he's like, eh. And then Marin is, you know, consoling him and says, you know, it's not that God is dead because there's so much evil in the world. We have to remember that God is here because, you know, of the good that does exist and that you have to cling to that. Desperately. So yeah, no, it's like great, great propaganda for the church and for social conservatism, which is actually like a big part of horror. As groovy and transgressive as horror can be, it also is a great tool for scaring people straight.
And also this film opened in 1973, which was the year that Roe versus Wade came into law. So, you know, there's also a factor of this sort of fear of, like, what's so scary about Regan is that she is, you know, sexual and she swears like a sailor and her face is covered in sores. And, you know, it's like, it has this sort of venereal horror aspect to it that is also a fear of a woman's sexuality. I mean, that's a very easy read of the movie.
Yeah, I don't think it's the main point that it's pushing, but it's definitely there. I also I don't see people talking about this as much, but there's an interesting kind of subsect of horror that is specifically about the fear parents have about their kids having access to phones. Like when phones become, and you see this later with like internet stuff, but there's I do think The Exorcist can be lumped into that insofar as like a Ouija board is a phone to Satan.
Like, yes,
because it's like, oh, you leave your kid alone with, you know, a phone / Ouija board, and then who knows what they're gonna do and who they're gonna let into their lives and that will influence them.
Yeah, I mean, this, and it's so you know, this is a single mother who works for a living instead of being the homemaker.
I thought you were going to do the Dolly Parton joke. Single mom who works two jobs.
But, you know, I don't, I mean, and I think that Friedkin to a certain extent is a reactionary in a good way.
I do too. I think he's, I think, I do in my heart think he's more liberal than Blatty, which is why I think the tension of having a groovy dude like Friedkin and a very stubborn conservative person like Blatty working together is actually super productive and interesting. Also, if anyone listening has yet to read the book The Exorcist, which was like a smash hit, like it was one of the first big pulp books to blow up alongside Rosemary's Baby, there's an audiobook out there. I can't remember who produced it, but it's narrated by Blatty and it's bonkers. It's so good. He like easily could have been an actor. Yeah, no, I'm serious. It's really, it's excellent. It's really, really good. So highly recommend. It's good. Also, doesn't Blatty have a cameo in The Exorcist? I can't remember.
Yeah, Blatty and Friedkin both have cameos.
Also, Blatty, best eyelashes in Hollywood.
And William Peter Blatty also wanted to play Father Karras in the movie, too. It wasn't Friedkin's idea of the character, so he said no. But looking at photos of Blatty, I think he could have conceivably have played the part.
He could have, but Jason Miller, you know, I think that's one of the most remarkable debut performances ever, of him being like, that's me, let me do it.
Yeah, I mean, the part had already been cast with Stacy Keach, but Jason Miller really, really twisted Friedkin's arm into letting him audition, even though the role had been cast. And Friedkin was actually very impressed with his work and decided, yeah, okay, you're the guy. And they paid Stacy Keach's contract out and recast.
Worth it, in my humble opinion.
Absolutely. Tell me a little bit about the Jason Miller performance in this film.
Oh, I think it's great. Like, I think it is dictionary definition brooding. Like, I think he gives Karras such a rich interior life without saying a lot. And I think he is a great, like, he's our audience surrogate. Like, he's, you know, waffling between, you know, a horrible life without God and his, you know, his faith. Like, he outright at one point is like, I have lost my faith. I'm in trouble. So he's, you know, our guy. We're supposed to be going on this journey, this conversion journey with him. And he has the biggest character development in that he finds God again, just in time to save Reagan. But no, I think it's an incredible performance. I mean, it's been talked about pretty ad nauseum at this point, but it's so naturalistic and rich. And I think a lot of that comes from his lived experience. Like, he, like, one of his pitches to Friedkin was like, this is me. Like, I am a failed priest. Please let me do this role. Yeah, no, he's great. He's also just got such a good 70s face. Like, it's just such a beautiful, light catching face. Yeah, no, I think it's such a empathetic performance.
And Friedkin liked to use a sort of like non-typical leading men faces, like how much he used Roy Scheider and also Jason Miller. Like, they're the sort of, that was that early 70s period where they were trying to cast regular looking guys as movie stars as opposed to movie stars as movie stars.
We used to be a society.
Yeah. We had faces then.
We had faces back then. Yeah.
Coming at The Exorcist decades later and watching it for the first time, I had all my ideas about what The Exorcist was going to be like. But one of the things that I hadn't thought about was Friedkin's background in documentary filmmaking. And there's so much stuff in this movie that feels like The French Connection and feels like the documentary work that inspired Friedkin in the first place when he decided to really go for it and direct films. There's a same cinematographer who shot The French Connection, Owen Roisman. But the sequences where he goes to visit his mother in her tenement apartment in New York, it really does have that autumnal vibes that The French Connection had. Like, it just, this movie makes you feel a little chilly while you're watching it because it takes place in the fall. But I wasn't expecting the New York City vibes in those sequences.
Yeah. Well, this was also from, you know, the half of Friedkin's career where he was still doing it live. And that rawness, like, this is kind of the catch 22 about this type of filmmaker from, you know, this period of film history in Hollywood where it's like, yeah, it wasn't ethical, but it made for a lot of really good cinema, man. Like, and yeah, no, it definitely feels very like raw and real, which I think is part of what made it so scary to people, was seeing something as fantastical as a possession be portrayed quote unquote, with a realistic eye. Yeah, I'm sure that had a lot of, that was behind a lot of the power of why people found it so terrifying. Also, you have to remember, like, I'm sure now that you've seen it, like, it's so easy to look back and be like, you know, how could they find that scary? But it's like, you have to remember, like, no one had access to anything. Like, no one knew what they were getting into. Some of the trailers were also genuinely scary. Like, they switched out composers halfway through, and one of the trailers had the original composer's work, and it is a trip. I highly recommend seeking it out.
Didn't they ban that trailer?
They did. It was too scary. It had flash. Yeah. It was, like, causing seizures. But yeah, no, the observation about Friedkin's documentary history is definitely apt. Like, I think as he got older and realized that doing it live wasn't worth it, you lost some of that, like, raw, like, exposed nerve feel. But I know a lot of bad things happen on the set, but it's really nice. It really, like, gives the film an energy that you just don't see anymore, which is good, but...
Well, maybe we should talk a little bit about the madness of a William Friedkin set at this point. Yeah. I want to tell you one funny story.
Funny?
This film, by this one's funny.
Okay.
The movie had a 224-day shooting schedule. Like, even something like Oliver Stone's JFK only took like 90 days, you know, like to do all that. This took 224 days.
What a maniac.
Now, whether that's perfectionism or getting very little done every day, or and Friedkin also brags that he's that take two is asking too much most of the time for him.
Like, what a liar. Hold on. You really can't trust anything that man says. I say that with love. Like, he's not trustworthy. He's like a sphinx. Like, it's not these riddles, man.
Well, another thing about Friedkin's documentary techniques is that he had, you know, he would light the set and he would have the actual like main camera crew there. But he also had a guy walking around with a little Bolex filming stuff handheld in a lit set that he was sort of capturing little details. And you can see a lot of that guy's work in the finished product. It's a very effective use of, it's like instead of having your second unit cameraman, you have your documentary guy working on the movie along with the actual film production crew.
Yeah, that actually makes me think of Zone of Interest, the new Glazer film, because they shot that like a multi-cam sitcom. Should have just had a Bolex guy, Jonathan.
Did you see Zone of Interest? Is it good?
I did. I think it was the best thing at TIFF, but also like easily the most contentious thing amongst critics at the festival, which in my opinion is how you know it's good. But yeah, good movie.
Plan now to stay home Tuesday. The Exorcist is coming to network television for the first time.
The problem with your daughter is not her bed. It's her brain.
Her 12-year-old daughter is suddenly transformed.
You tell me you know for a fact that an exorcism wouldn't do any good.
Her mother go to save her. The Exorcist Tuesday.
The Exorcist is a film dealing with the supernatural. Parental discretion is advised.
When I was a kid, I would get really, really scared of horror movies when they'd be on TV. But what scared me, and maybe was sort of like the beginnings of my sort of film nerd tendencies later in life, was what really used to scare me about horror movies when they were on TV was the viewer discretion is advised warnings. Being told that something scary is coming scared me. Like, I didn't have to see the actual scary thing.
Well, I'm not surprised then that you didn't see The Exorcist, because like there was a shitload of publicity being like, it's the scariest movie ever made, and you would have been like, great, not seen it.
It didn't appear on network television until 1980.
That checks out. I feel like you know, preteen stabbing herself in the vagina with a crucifix is a hard sell for network television.
When it finally did air on CBS, William Friedkin did the dubbing himself of the demon when the demon was swearing.
Oh, I've heard that. Which is like, you know, an affront to Mercedes McCambridge, God rest her soul, fucking goat. But
yeah.
I love her so much. Have you seen the behind the scenes video where she's describing her process and you're like,
yes,
this woman should be on Mount Rushmore? Like, Like, so Mercedes New Cambridge is like, 1950s star. She's in Johnny Guitar famously. And she's just like a hard woman. Like, she's a hard lady, hard church going woman. And she like was off, or she, yeah, she was off the wagon when they started. Cause I think they originally, they had another plan for the dub and then it wasn't working or something. So they brought Mercedes McCambridge in, and Mercedes McCambridge was like, I'm going to start drinking. Like, I'm going all in, baby. So she like got shit faced before every recording and like gargled a horrible concoction and like smoked like a mad woman and just like was a woman possessed. And I know there was like shenanigans later about the crediting of it or something, but it's such an iconic performance. Like, I think Mercedes McCambridge, like, that is one of the greatest, you know, vocal performances ever. And like, I think she would like ask to be restrained while she was doing it. And she'd like bring her personal priest. Like, anyway, I respect the hell out of it. All these fucking Daniel Day-Lewis people can suck dick. Like, she was, she was the OG.
Well, and also interestingly, considering Friedkin's easygoing stuff about gender norms and things like that, Friedkin wanted a gender neutral voice to be the demon. He didn't want it to sound like a man or a woman.
So ahead of his time.
So he chose Mercedes McCambridge, who was a neutral sounding voice, in his words, of movies that he'd seen a long time ago.
Oh, I'm sure he was like, she was like, I'm going to kill myself for this. And he was like, great, excellent. We understand each other. Like, yeah, no, she's incredible. She also, there's also like, if you want to get her vibe, there's a great video on YouTube from some old film where she single-handedly rolls a cigarette in one hand while delivering a monologue. And it's like, she should be on Currency, in my opinion.
Linda Blair was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. In the original release prints of The Exorcist, McCambridge was not credited. When Blair was nominated for an Oscar, the stories came out that, in fact, some of her performance is a different actress, and it basically sandbagged the idea of her winning the Oscar that year. It damaged her chances. The punchline to this is that Friedkin was so eager to work with McCambridge, and in 1980, when CBS did the network television version, he said he didn't want to work with her again. So he did the voice.
This is why you can't trust him.
Yeah.
He's slippery.
What other horror stories are there from the production in terms of Hurricane Billy being a madman?
Oh, he wasn't getting like a shocked reaction the way he wanted. So he just literally fired a shotgun on the set, like a live ammunition, just to like get a jolt. Yeah. Which is definitely one way to do that. I know that Eileen Bernstein got like slammed across a room so hard that she permanently broke. Was it her
coccyx? Her coccyx. Yeah, she the scene where Reagan whips her off the bed and she smashes into the wall, and the scream that she lets out is the scream of her being in pain from her back pain.
Yeah, that's probably the most famous one. I know that also Jason Miller getting a face full of slime was also not scripted, and Hurricane Billy was just like, I think we should just ruins. And he was apparently really mad. I don't know. A lot of people got like very hurt on this movie.
And the other irresponsible moment was that he cast an actual priest as one of the priests, Father Dyer, who was played by Father William O'Malley, who was apparently a critic of the book. And he even told William Peter Blatty that he had problems with that character in the novel. So Friedkin's revenge was he cast him as that character.
And, I think
that's great. So he's the priest that administers the last rites to Father Karras after he falls down the stairs at the end of the film. But he didn't like the intensity of the line delivery. He kept telling him, you know, you got to do it again. You got to do it better. And the priest was like, I can't do it any better. And then Friedkin says, all right, do you trust me? And he says, yes.
Oh, I forgot about this.
He says, do you love me? And he says, I love you. And he says, do you trust me? And he said, I trust you. And then Friedkin punched him in the face and then called action.
See, like, so, I know that's not ethical, but like, but like, there, you can't argue with the results.
And in this documentary that I watched, that I recommend if you are wanting
great.
More
it's really
Exorcist
solid.
Stuff,
all that called, that Bolex B-roll gets to shine.
Yeah, but the documentary is called Leap of Faith: William Friedkin on The Exorcist, and it's very enjoyable too, because it's kind of like you kind of wish that this documentary filmmaker had done features on every single one of Friedkin's films, because all it is 90
minutes.
No,
he would have been put in prison.
But Friedkin admits, after saying that he was firing ammo off on the set and punching out his actors, that maybe in today's, you know, politically correct times, that wouldn't be acceptable.
Listen, he ultimately learned his lesson, so it's fine. And no one died, John Landis. So
that's true. One funny egomaniac detail on the production was that Friedkin had a special director's chair made on the set. And on the back of the chair, it said, an Oscar for The French Connection, to the left of his name. And to the right, there was an outline of an Oscar with a question mark next to it.
How can you hate this man? He's the best.
He was like going for it.
I think it's so funny.
So let's also talk about one of the most effective sequences in the movie, the discombobulating opening of the film that starts in Iraq.
Oh, my dumbass brain was like, the pee scene? No, the Iraq scene is confusing.
So the movie starts in northern Iraq. Apparently, when they were adapting the book, Friedkin was surprised to get a draft of the screenplay by William Peter Blatty, and he actually hated it and tossed it.
Very funny. Again, good bit. like, you don't understand the source material that you wrote.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, he said something like, if your worst enemy had done this to you, you know, he said something like, you know, your worst enemy wouldn't even do this to you. But his own writing.
Fuck.
So they started the film in Iraq, and they really did film in Iraq. But I read that at the time, the U.S. didn't have diplomatic relations with Iraq. So Friedkin was basically running and gunning over there in a country with no diplomatic relationship with an English film crew. And that incredible archaeological dig at the beginning is an actual archaeological dig that was happening when they got there.
Color me shocked that Friedkin just filmed a real thing happening.
And also, on top of the madness of filming this opening sequence in Iraq, he also had Max von Sydow in old man makeup that took 4 hours to apply.
Which is a whole, here's why it's such funny old man makeup, is that he looks worse and more haggard in the old man makeup than he actually did when he reached that age.
Yeah. But this was the thing that confused me so much. I mean, The Exorcist led to, even though I had never seen it, it led to all these confusions in my life. Like, I knew that Max von Sydow played the elderly priest in The Exorcist, but what I didn't know was that that was old man makeup and he was only 43 years old. So
did Dick Smith do that makeup? That's like, if so, that's like a massive fucking compliment to the chef as far as old man makeup goes.
Well, even his hands were all marbled and, you know, he had elderly hands as well as a face. Dick but Smith he's also misses, filming man. In 45 degrees Celsius weather. Like, having him in the makeup chair for 4 hours and then in the blazing hot sun.
Yeah, for a Scandinavian man, that must have been pretty bad. It's the worst thing Friedkin did on that set, for sure.
but it led to a lifetime of confusion. Like, why is Max von Sydow younger
aging
now?
I don't understand.
Why does he look young now? Yeah. Like, when I saw Strange Brew, it's like, wait a minute, I thought he was 80 years old from The Exorcist. How is he only 50
now? The timeline's not timelining.
So a lot of people were confused as to what the beginning of the movie means. And it was obviously Friedkin trying to get in on the sort of Stanley Kubrick ideas of, you know, having a sort of the dawn of man kind of sequence. Like, I think he wanted to confuse the audience from the beginning and to not have the audience know what this all leads to. I like how it finally ties together by the end of the movie, but that opening prologue doesn't feel like it has anything to do with the rest of the movie.
No, I think you want it to go to
And you don't even see Father Merrick for another hour. You see him at the beginning, and then you don't see him at all for an hour.
Yeah, it's... I don't think ill of anyone who finds it confusing or superfluous, because it is. Do be like that. Looks pretty, though. Looks good. And it's, you know what, honestly, if that entire preamble was just justification to be able to have that incredible shot of Reagan reaching upwards with the backlit statue, like, that's mm-hmm. enough reason for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the penny drop moment. It was like, oh, now I understand the beginning of the movie with 20 minutes to go. Because I didn't understand it while I was watching it. I wasn't quite sure why we're all of a sudden in Georgetown hanging out with this career woman actress and her troubled young daughter when the movie started with the archaeological dig in Iraq.
Basic magic trick. Just distracting you.
I guess. And an old priest popping nitroglycerin pills. I guess that's a preview of Sorcerer in a way.
He'd long since learned his lesson about, or no, he hadn't learned his lesson about doing it live on Sorcerer. It was to live and die in LA, where he was finally restrained, learned about stunt coordinators.
Learning how to get location permits, because French Connection was famously, the car chases in that movie were done without permission.
But that's what makes them good. That's why they're good, is that pedestrians almost died.
Also, Friedkin got permission to film on the subway train by giving an MTA employee a bag of money.
Yeah. I mean, cruising's the same, right? Like, the reason Cruising rips is because it's effectively one of the most salient pieces of documentary footage we have about the New York City leather scene. Mm-hmm. And the reason it slaps so hard is that Friedkin, like, knew people in the scene and, like, could, like, get, like, he had so many fingers and so many pies. God rest his soul. Pazuzu, mm-hmm. rest his soul.
Let's talk also about the way that The Exorcist depicts medical science. One of the points that the movie's making is that, in a weird way, is that it has a sort of vague distrust for science. I guess that's why people love this movie so much, who also love the Catholic Church. The idea of psychiatry and medication. You know, they mention Ritalin, I think, at one point, and she's got psychiatrists who the one thing that doesn't quite make sense about this movie is why the doctors come and see this girl who's now got like pustules all over her face, talking like a demon and saying, oh, she's probably got a lesion in her brain. Like, it doesn't she looks more like she's been possessed by the devil, doctor.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the film outright mistrusts science. I think the thesis it's actually trying to push is that there are certain problems that science can't fix, that like certain archaic problems require archaic solutions. And that like there's the realm of science and then there's the realm of religion and never the twain shall meet. Like, it's the doctors who recommend that she go to an exorcist. Which I believe is almost like a, you know, an attempt to have folks not of faith to be on board with it, to be like, well, if the doctor's recommending that they go see, and even then, right, like the way that exorcism is represented in the film is like, it's the dirty little secret that they bring out of the closet when they really need to. But like, even the church isn't super, you know, enthused about this rite. Yeah, I don't think the film is anti-science in the way that some genre films are, but I do think it's like drawing a line in the sand, being like, there are limits to which modern medical science can like be helpful. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you got to call a priest. So.
But some of the loudest and scariest sounds in the movie is the sounds of the medical equipment when she's being put through all the tests. You know, like she goes through an arterial catheter scene that's really hard to watch.
Yeah, easily the hardest things to watch in that film are the 1970s medical stuff, where I'm just like, no, I don't. Compounded by, you know, the spicy piece of trivia that a future murderer is in some of those scenes, like accidentally by no, like, like they're definitely like, that doesn't help with the already creepy, you know, aspects of all the invasive, ooky spooky medical procedures.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'll get to that in a minute. But But, you know, like I also, in terms of my own standards of what I find gross is that I can watch The Thing and I can watch a dog being torn apart by the evil alien creature, you know, the chest cavity with the being opened up and chomping the guy's arms off. But the sure. part in The Thing that makes me cringe the most is this scene where they're getting the blood samples out of their thumbs in the petri dishes.
So I have a funny story about this. So my I have a good pal named Jesse, who's a film buff and also formerly an academic, and he used to teach a sci-fi course, and he was screening The Thing, and of course all these like young students were, you know, giggling and laughing at these quote unquote outdated practical effects, because, you know, whatever. And then when this thumb slice scene came, they all were like, ah! And I could like see my friend Jesse like in the front row just being like, what? Are you kidding me? Like, and so I'm glad to hear this is like a universal experience, but it's something we can relate to, right? Like I can't relate mm-hmm. to, you know, having my face chomped on by a guy's former face that is now a mouth. But like, I cannot imagine the sensation of cutting my thumb with a scalpel.
Yeah. So, but that's why that scene with the arterial catheter is so cringe inducing, because I can see a medical procedure where, you know, a little poke gets done in your throat and then the spray, the arterial spray is coming out until they affix the catheter to it. It's very difficult to watch, even though it's just a medical procedure, but it's one of the grisliest moments in the movie, even yeah, though easily. So much of the movie is, you know,
science.
I know, but following up on what you mentioned a second ago, that the weird coincidence about that sequence is that there's an X-ray technician at NYU's medical center who was cast to do what he would normally do for a procedure like that in the movie. The guy's name was Paul Bateson, and in 1979, years after The Exorcist, that guy was convicted of the murder of a film critic, and he was sentenced to 20 years. Behind bars, he boasted that he had committed spree killings in gay bars in New York. He had killed and dismembered 6 men and disposed of their remains in plastic bags. He was believed to be the killer by investigators, but he was never charged. Those killings remained unsolved, but that crime was fictionalized as the inspiration for Friedkin's Cruising a few years later. So it makes me wonder whether Friedkin met the guy who would later inspire Cruising.
It is like good film. It's a good story, right? Like I think Friedkin, a lot of the stories he repeats often are just really mm-hmm. good stories. Like I'm sure that they're not true, but who cares? They said there's truthiness there mm-hmm. in a way that I choose to cling to.
And also coming at Exorcist late in all my viewings of Friedkin's movies, I also detected some parallels between the X-ray sequences in that film where they're, you know, putting up the X-rays of Reagan's skull with all the counterfeiting and To Live and Die in L.A.
Oh, totally.
With all the sheets yeah. of money and stuff like that. Like he covers both those sequences in the same kind of style.
Yeah. Documentary fetishism, man. Because he like very famously like knew people who did counterfeiting and like asked them how to do it, and mm-hmm. yeah, to the point where I think like a child of one of the production assistants like stole some of the counterfeit bills, and it was like very bad. Like the government got involved. Like, but yeah, no, he's like such a little hoe for like the blurry line between fiction and reality. Like, yeah, totally.
But I think that that's the secret to why The Exorcist works so well, because does feel 100%. Real, even though so much of what's happening is not real. And in fact, ludicrous. It's ludicrous to me that this girl is like green and blue and speaking in tongues. And the doctors are like, maybe you might want to see an exorcist about this.
We're stumped.
Yeah. It's like, take 2 of these and call me in the morning. You know, like, it's like the doctors are trying to sort of say, you know, well, your little daughter's got a lesion in her head, even though she's, you know, the bed is shaking and she's levitating in midair. This was all a mystery to the medical profession.
I mean, it's a classic, like, we're out of our depth. Yeah, which is just, you know, the film's thesis that sometimes you need the daddy of the church
Yeah. I also LOL'd in those scenes where the Catholics...
Sorry.
In that scene where the Catholics are deciding to take on the case, they have this priest saying, okay, we've got to get Father Merrick. It was like...
It's very like getting ready to rob a bank, where it's like, okay, get the gang together. Get our ringer.
And Merrick's walking around like in the woods, like that scene in Oppenheimer with Einstein walking around.
Yes.
Somebody runs up to him with a little piece of paper.
Yes. Like, you're needed. Oh, okay.
Okay. Fun fact, the cab that drops Max von Sydow off at the McNeil residence, the cab driver is William Friedkin.
Oh, wow. I'm so shocked.
He worked in a juicy role for himself. Yeah. It's funny, in the documentary that I watched, Friedkin is constantly talking about all the inspiration that he took from paintings when he was working on The Exorcist. And
he's a fancy boy. He directed opera for a while. He's like, he's a Renaissance man. And also, like, you get that in Jade, where, like, the arguably, like, maybe the most accomplished part of Jade in the beginning, like the opening sequence where it's all of, it's like in, it's not Friedkin's house, but it's like his art that he's collected. Like, he wants you to know that he's a man of culture.
He also wants you to know that, like Rene Magritte and Monet, he's a great artist too.
I mean, I think so.
Well, he is, but, you know, but take it from him. He's a great artist.
I do. I love an artist that is so confident. It's great. Be obsessed with yourself.
We haven't talked really about Ellen Burstyn in this film too much. She's good.
No, or Linda Blair. Well, we famously hate women like this movie, so.
That's right.
No, Ellen Burstyn's great. Like,
I wonder why she didn't want to do Exorcist 2, but she did want to do Exorcist Believer. I mean, now I know why she wanted to do the new one.
Cox is hurting.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
Burstyn agreed to be an Exorcist Believer because she wanted to put an endowment together for an acting school.
Okay, so, that's cute.
You know, no money is worth it to have to say, they wouldn't let me into the exorcism because of the patriarchy.
Yeah, that's bad. I hope that got a laugh at your screening.
I didn't see Exorcist Believer. What do you think?
Okay, good, me neither. In loving memory of Billy, I'm not seeing it.
Yeah.
It's what he would have wanted.
You know, there's a funny tweet that he wrote when Exorcist was coming down the pipe.
Yes, it's great. Honestly, good Twitter user, William Friedkin. Another part of...
I loved his tweets. There was
they
funny...
were great.
Do you know this hilarious guy named Zodiac Motherfucker?
I sure
Twitter.
Do. Yes.
At one point, he wrote a tweet where he said that he loved Rampage and that it was a great film. And Friedkin responded to say, of all of the films that I've made, why that one?
I think it's so funny. I think he had a great sense of humor. I think that's honestly the thing I respect the most about William Friedkin is, like, he absolutely knew how to take a joke.
Yeah. Well, that Nicholas Winding Refn video is them joking around. It's not actually
100%. Yeah, no, people
angry
at him. No, well, he like looks into the camera like it's The Office. Like, they're clearly having a good time. It's great.
A Friedkin tweet from December 17th, 2020. I wish I could do a William Friedkin imitation.
Just do a Trump imitation. It's the same accent.
He says, there's a rumor on IMDb that I'm involved with a new version of The Exorcist. This isn't a rumor. It's a flat out lie. There's not enough money or motivation in the world to get me to do this.
It's the motivation for me.
Yeah.
He's like, I would have done it for the money.
Yeah. We were robbed when Friedkin died because his final film was released posthumously for Showtime. And we didn't get the Hurricane Billy tour of him trashing Exorcist Believer because he probably wasn't allowed to do it. He probably had some contractual thing where he has to be quiet for 2 years. But can you imagine Friedkin going off on it? You've seen the incredible footage of him going off on Exorcist 2, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. That's required reading.
He took such delight in
That's the thing, is he's like slagging on it, but like you can tell that he is like adding years to his life in doing so. Like I think it gave him a lot of power. Like I think his mana bar expanded.
Well, we got the trailer for Exorcist Believer before Oppenheimer, and there was a collective groan in the theater when they realized, because at first it just looked like a ripoff of The Exorcist, but then the music came on, and then the audience was like, oh, God.
Good. That's the correct. That's the correct response. Also, speaking of Exorcist ripoffs, like, there are good ones out there. Like, just go to the off-brand shit. It's just as, it's like a good time. You don't have to slag off your time in the minds of the certified, you know, sequels that suck. Like Manitou exists, Beyond the Door exists. There's good stuff out there.
Oh my God. I love the Manitou so much.
Yeah, Manitou good.
Yeah, I'll put the trailer for the Manitou on the show description for this episode. Huge laughs. In the trailer for the Manitou, the shot of Tony Curtis in the trailer is like a door opening and him screaming.
Yeah, it's good.
I'm trying to remember. There were cash-ins on the Exorcist success in the immediate wake. Like there was Audrey Rose. Did you ever see that? That was
I've seen. You know what? Not only have I seen Audrey Rose, the way that Anthony Hopkins says Audrey Rose just plays in my head every now and then because that name gets repeated so often. Also, like a great, you know, argument for why Clark Kent would bamboozle people, because I did not recognize Anthony Hopkins like for a while because I think he has like a mustache and I was like, who's that? Audrey Rose, it's okay. You could be watching The Manitou or Beyond the Door. There's other options.
This was The Exorcist was the first horror movie to get nominated for Best Picture. I find that very hard to believe that it took that
first
long.
First and second, I believe, if you want to be incredibly generous to The Shape of Water.
Yes. I was getting a headache that year when people were saying that The Shape of Water was the first science fiction movie or the first horror movie to win Best Picture.
It's like, I choose to believe that that's trolling, that that's not genuine. I don't want to go down this rabbit hole. I'm pulling the plug on you giving me an aneurysm this late. It's not happening. Where's my shotgun?
Adjusted for inflation, Barbie is now the top grossing Warner Brothers movie of all time, but it beat out The Exorcist. It was number one until this year. Still.
Okay, but Barbie never stabs her vagina with a crucifix. Maybe that's why she goes to the gynecologist at the end. She's like, I need to make this happen.
It did win. It was up for 10 Oscars. It only won two. It won adapted screenplay for William Peter Blatty, and it also won Best Sound. The sound in this movie is incredible. Let's talk a little bit about that.
It's so good. I like it. It's, and you know what? The sound in To Live and Die in LA, also good. I just saw it recently at the VIF Theater here in Vancouver. And I was like, oh my God, this is like some of the best sound design I've ever heard. Like, I think William Friedkin makes space for excellent sound design in a way that really, like, you can notice. Like, it's not the kind of sound design that's meant to be silent or like unnoticeable. Like, it is noticeably incredible. It's so good.
And also uses tricks of the trade in terms of like backwards sounds, which is made literal in the movie. Like they actually, you hear some backwards sounding voices and then they play the tape backwards so that you can hear what they're saying.
You have to remember, like at the time, this was new for people.
There wasn't even stereo sound in movie theaters yet in 1973. It would have been a mono.
Okay, you don't have to include this because you've triggered a fun fact that Meg knows. But back in the day, Fantasia basically invented stereo before stereo. It was called Fantasound, and they just put a shitload of speakers with different channels all over the theaters, and it was incredibly expensive, and it's part of the reason Fantasia made negative money. But Fantasound basically invented stereo in like whatever. 30s? 40s?
40s.
But yeah, you can look up the patent for Fantasound. Highly recommend if you're a freak like me. but yeah, part of the equation of why Fantasia almost ruined Disney was that they invented stereo the hard way.
when you and I did the show on The Blob, it was a pleasure because you had all this inside information on all the goop, the goop, and how they did all the incredible goopy effects. Do you know how they were able to achieve some of the effects that they did in The Exorcist?
You know what? I've never dug into it. It's on my bucket list. It's also one of those things where it's Friedkin, so a lot of it is like them just straight up launching people across rooms. Very famously, the vomit is pea soup. I think it was like other food items. Like, I think it must have been an incredibly stinky set, except for I think they refrigerated the set. Like, it was actually cold. Which is like one of the joys of watching 70s cinema is like when you do see cold breath. It's real, baby.
I hate CGI cold breath. That was very,
it bothers me.
Do you remember in The Social Network when they did it and it was just so obvious that they had done it?
Well, and it's like, I feel like it's a very, I feel like Canadians are very attuned to it. The other one that really gets me is when tires squeal on snow and I'm like, come on. No, I mean, famously, they built like a pretty freaking compelling puppet for Reagan for the 360 head spin. But like a lot of that is just Linda Blair thrashing around like a maniac. Like it's remarkable how much of this film is just what you see is what you get. Like considering, like you said, how fantastical it is. I think some of the more striking shots, like her levitating off the bed, or even like any time something happens where the laws of physics are being broken, I don't know if they built a rig. That's what I would imagine, is that they built like a wooden rig. I don't know. I've never dug into it. I think in part because it does preserve some of the magic of the film for me, but I am, as you know, curious. One of these days. Yeah, the real one I would like to know is how they did the stunt of the guy launching himself down the stairs, because that's a great fall.
And the part that I was like, how did they do that, was when she was convulsing. It looked like she was on it looked like she was on a machine. It looked like they had hidden it.
It might be hydraulic, if I had to guess. As a person who knows some stuff, I would guess that it was hydraulic and it was bouncing and she was also convulsing. But man, I think Linda Blair was a little dynamo. Like, she got such fucking bullshit for being in this movie. Like, she got hate mail, she got death threats. Like, I haven't really looked up her speaking about her experience on the film recently, but I do feel bad for her. Like, I think she absorbed a lot of the ire people had towards the film, like concerned groups, like people who misunderstood the film. Like, it's always funny to me when I read about Christian, you know, whatever, watchdog groups from the 70s who were like trying to get the film banned. And I'm like, it's good for you.
I know.
It's good for business.
Anyway. Yeah, it's as good for business as The Passion of the Christ was, you know?
Yeah.
Although, there's too much swearing in it, I suppose. Maybe it was more like Father Stew. Do you remember Father Stew?
I know what that is.
That was the movie made for a Catholic audience, but it had so much swearing in it that it was rated R, and then it wasn't all that popular.
I mean,
church groups couldn't go to it because it was too profane. Yeah. And so I guess this church, movie would
The Vatican famously loved The Exorcist because they were like, it's good for business, baby. Those were their words, I think. Exactly.
There was a funny part in the Leap of Faith documentary where Friedkin was talking about a yelling match that he got into with Bernard Herrmann.
Good.
Over Excellent. The music.
I can see it now.
He even asked Bernard Herrmann to do the score for this film. He showed him a cut of the movie and Herrmann said, I'll save this piece of shit. and started making recommendations for all the stuff out. He told him to cut out the whole opening scene in Iraq. And Friedkin just basically shook his hand and said, well, thank you for meeting me. Very nice to meet you. And he said, that was one of the worst disappointments of my life. And then the Lalo Schifrin soundtrack, he actually threw the recording out the window.
Oh, I've heard that. Parking lot. That's temperate for Hurricane Billy.
Yeah. And then he finally heard Tubular Bells and he was like, I love it.
Okay. This is pretty good.
So, Meg, as we wrap up our Exorcist chat, I wanted to do a little lightning round with you on your takes on the Exorcist sequels.
Okay.
Because there are now five of them. We will ignore the new one, But what do you think of John Boorman's Exorcist 2?
Better than most things in theaters these days. Like, John Boorman is such a sweetie. Like, he was offered Exorcist. He was like, no, 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 too ooky spooky. No, thank you. And then did Exorcist 2 in an attempt to, like, bring some goodness back into the story, and which is not the vibe. Well, it is the vibe, but, like, the Catholic way is not to, you know, to bury that lead. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, everyone knows it was a mistake, but compared to, I don't know, Exorcist Believer, it belongs in a museum, so.
It has a fantastic Ennio Morricone score. It has incredible overacting.
There's lots to love.
Louise Fletcher is hilarious in it. There's a part in Exorcist 2 where Louise Fletcher says to Richard Burton, "What are we dealing with, Father?" And and Richard Burton says, "Evil."
Yeah, it's good. How can you hate that? That's a whole extra star, in my opinion.
He says, "I flew with Pazuzu." Because Pazuzu doesn't appear in the first one. Pazuzu's in part two.
Yeah, there's no name till part two.
He's not named in part one.
Exorcist 2 proposes that Regan McNeil is actually the next step in human evolution and she has healing powers, and I think that's funny. So that's my opinion.
Famous bomb. Friedkin was delighted when it bombed. But I will defend Exorcist 2. I like it.
Yeah, it's a good time. People who think it's bad either haven't seen it or they haven't watched enough bad movies, in my opinion.
It has a tap dancing number in it. Exorcist doesn't have tap dancing.
Incredible. Incredible argumentation there.
Exorcist 3, a.k.a. Legion, directed by William Peter Blatty. Good movie.
Masterpiece. Like, straight up masterpiece. William Peter Blatty, two films, both bangers. Comeback King from the dead. I don't know.
There'll be a Ninth Legion Configuration episode of this show at some point.
Oh, it's so good. Ninth Configuration is so good. No. Like, Exorcist 3 is, like, it's one of those things where you see hyperbolic tweets from horror people and you're like, how good could it be? And then you watch and you're like, oh, it's really good. And you don't need to have seen Exorcist 1 or 2. Very standalone. Dorsey Scott's in it. He's great. It includes famously one of, you know, the most calculated and deserved jump scares of all time. It features, I think, the best Brad Dourif horror performance outside of the Child's Play franchise by, like, a long shot. And it stars a previous friend of the show, Merlin from Excalibur.
That's right.
Five stars. Five stars.
And it also has Patrick Ewing and Fabio.
How can the masterpiece movie? It's so good. It's like perfect for Christmas. We love a Christmas horror film. I don't know, man.
Yeah. And, and I had never seen The Exorcist, but I loved Exorcist 2 and Exorcist 3. I had a working knowledge of what happens in The Exorcist. That was fine. And in a way, I think it added to my enjoyment of
I think an exorcism happens.
But, like, I wasn't like, he doesn't look anything like Lee J. Cobb or anything like that. Sure. I didn't have any baggage. I was able to enjoy Exorcist 3 as a straight up horror movie with, you know, a little background.
I mean, I feel like even the Cobb heads were like, George C. Scott, like, I'm in, baby.
Now, what have you seen the famous Morgan Creek double bill of two Exorcist movies that they released? One where they fired Paul Schrader and then they replaced him with Rennie Harlan. But in fact, both of those movies did see the light of day. Have you seen either of them?
So long ago that I can't answer questions about it. I have, but no recollection. No imprint on my brain.
I feel like I should try watching the Paul Schrader Exorcist movie on principle. I don't feel that strongly about a Rennie Harlan Exorcist movie. But
I feel like even though they think suffering is a faith-based work, I feel like the Catholics would forgive you for not looking at that.
And they did say that Exorcist Believer is the first part of a new trilogy that they're spending like $400 million on. But I don't think the response to Believer was strong enough to warrant a new trilogy. At least
Satan,
Halloween
intercede.
Did well.
We were joking off pod about this, but like I would rather have 10 Whoopi Halloweens than any more David Gordon Green abominations. Like it's just so frustrating. Like there are incredible examples out there of revisits of legacy horror things. Like New Nightmare is great. I don't think we have bested New Nightmare in terms of like how to approach revamping a legacy horror franchise. Like I just think it's been done well. So when you do it poorly, it is obvious and bad. Even the 2013 Evil Dead, that's good shit. That's like how you do it, man. It's embarrassing. Stop embarrassing us. Like, you're making the brand look bad. Where's the Vatican when you need them?
Have you seen the Pope's Exorcist?
Well, yeah, but that has Russell Crowe in it, so it good. He big boy. He drive around in Vespa. It's good stuff.
But I believe that it's based on the Vatican priest that Friedkin made a documentary about as well. Isn't it? Loosely? I never saw that.
I did, and I do not recall. I did not investigate further. They had me at Big Man Tiny Scooter. That's as far as my brain went.
I was sorely tempted to see it because I think that Russell Crowe, he's valuable in the sense that he is the new Richard Burton, in the sense that he'll make a movie.
Oh yeah, you need a big guy.
See based on the poster alone. Like yeah, oh easily. Richard, like Richard Burton could have been in a movie called The Pope's Exorcist. Actually,
that
kind
is
of
how-
was.
That's how I watched Medusa Touch. I was like in the Tubi mines toiling away and I was like, Richard Burton, let's go. And then I was like, oh, it's actually good. Like, which is not always the case with a Richard Burton pick.
Well, that came out when I was a kid and I remember laughing so hard at the poster because it was just a picture of Richard Burton looking like he just wet himself.
He might have.
The poster just says telekinesis with a picture of Richard Burton. It was like, that's all you need to do to sell tickets.
Okay, but that undersells that Medusa Touch actually a good movie, to be fair. Yeah.
Meg, before we go, do you want to let me know what spooky stuff you're getting up to over at Film School Rejects this month? I know this is your season.
Yes. So the 31 Days of Horror List project chugs along. I think this is our sixth year, which is stupid. And we're getting to the point now where like we still have like lists that I think are pretty like general, but we're narrowing things down in such a way where like we just published a list of the best organ transplant horror films. And you'd think, how could you make a top 10 list about that? Turns out rather easily. There are quite a lot. We just celebrated Brad Dourif's performances outside of the Child's Play franchise. Guess what was number one? It was Exorcist 3. So yeah, there's a new top 10 list about various incredibly niche horror topics every day on Film School Rejects in October. And we're deep in the pits now. So like some of it's getting real specific, like, but I find those lists fun personally. Like I think that's where you get some real gold. So
yeah,
like, oh, so I forced the rest of the group. There's like five of us that do this. And I was like, we're going to do a best Udo Kier performances list. And then I swiftly remembered immediately that The Kingdom doesn't count as a movie. And I was like, fuck, like, damn it. I love Udo Kier.
Was the Madonna video that he's in, is that on the list?
Not a movie. Oh my God, I love Udo Kier so much. He's our tallest slimy little guy. He's like over 6 foot.
Oh, like, I didn't know that. I thought he was like a little man.
No. He's a giant, but he gives off such little stinker energy. Yeah. Oh, here's a plug. Both of the Criterion editions of Flesh for Frankenstein and Blood for Dracula just dropped on Criterion, including the commentary tracks. And oh my God, they're incredible. They're so good. Udo Kier is just vibing. It's the best. Highly recommend. They're both very, very, very good movies, but the commentary tracks are fresh, like so good. Because it's like, it's Udo Kier being like, yeah, so I'm in love with my sister here. And I think it's because I was working so hard. And I just like, I could not go dating. So like, she was there. So we married. Like, it's so good. He's a great little guy.
Did you ever hear the incredible Abel Ferrara Driller Killer commentary track?
No, but thank you. I love a...
You have to. It's only like, yeah. I think he bails out after about a half an hour, but it's incredible.
Very on brand. Also, I just watched The Addiction recently. Good fucking movie.
Good movie.
I feel like, I know like boys are like this, girls are like this is like bad comedy, but I do think like philosophy PhD boys be like Rope, girl philosophy PhDs be like The Addiction. Like, I do think that tracks.
On the Driller Killer commentary track, Ferrara's just complaining because his ex-wife is
good.
The female lead in the movie, and at one point there's like a shot in the film and he says, there's a fucking competent shot for once. And then he's like, ah, fuck it, and then he leaves after about a half an hour.
Fuck, that's so funny. I respect that. Like, I just listened to the, not just, I recently listened to the Rob Zombie House of a Thousand Corpses soundtrack, and he's just like, oh man, House of a Thousand Problems. Like, he's not happy. And I'm like, it would have been very funny if he's just like, I'm gonna go hang out with my wife. Bye.
Well, Meg, thank you so much for joining me once again on the show. And where can my listeners find you?
I'm at The Worst Nun on Twitter, and also on Blue Sky, and my rating is on CinemaScope and Film School Rejects, and that's it. That's where I'm at.
Well, Meg, thank you so much for joining me. Please come back anytime.
Oh my God, at your peril. Like, we got to talk about the ninth configuration.
Yeah. Okay, let's do it in the new year.
We got to go to space.
Before we go, just a reminder that we do have a Patreon, and patrons help to make Junk Filter possible. To become a patron, to support the show directly, and to receive access to bonus episodes every month, please go to patreon.com/junkfilter. And please follow us on Twitter @junkfilterpod. We'll have another episode in the next few days. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you for listening.